The Team Never Quit podcast is sponsored by Navy Federal Credit Union. Becoming a member at Navy Federal can help you earn more and save more. You can learn all about this at NavyFederal.org.
Yeah, do your job, do it well, grind, you know, just come to work with a good attitude and grind. And then you'll be asked to do things and doors will open. And
never quit. Team Never Quit Radio.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the TNQ podcast. I'm your host, Marcus Luttrell. Every week, it's my job to fire you up, to ignite the legend inside of you, and to push you to your greatness. Join me every week as I take you into my briefing room with some of the most hard-charging people on the planet. They're going to show you how to embrace the suck of life, teach you the values of working your ass off, and charge through whatever life throws at you. This is the Team Never Quit podcast. So buckle up, Buttercup.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of the Team Never Quit podcast. As always, thank you guys for listening and watching, and please don't forget to hit that like and subscribe button wherever you get your show. So today, before we get to our special guest, let's get to our weekly Patreon question of the day. And today we have, so we know that you guys have done some pretty extraordinary things, but what is one thing that still remains on your bucket list?
Like an adrenaline kind of thing or just extreme thing?
I mean, just anything on your bucket list. What do you still want to do that you haven't done?
For me, it's travel. I have like a whole long list of places that I want to go. I've already been to a bunch of places, but I still want to see more.
God, that's a good question, man. I feel like some of these spur of the moment ones desire, you know, they deserve a little bit more thought. What do you got to think, Chris?
Well, I kind of like what Melia was saying. For me, I've seen New Zealand from space and seen pictures of it, and it looks amazing in both senses that I've never been there. So going to New Zealand is on a list for me.
Hunter, hey, that place is great.
Yeah. Hunter and I went for his high school graduation trip. And it was, I think that's the most beautiful
place on the planet. I think that's where they filmed Lord of the Rings, if I'm not mistaken. The Kiwis are great. The people are awesome. Mm-hmm. I mean, you want to talk about traveling back into it. It's something up there. It's so dang far away. You know? I mean, it's far away.
It's far away. Yeah, about as, you know, if you go east or west, it's about the same amount of time, is, I think.
New Zealand, to me, when we were driving through the North and South Island, it's like a mixture of Ireland, Scotland, Hawaii, and Switzerland, like the Alps.
Wow.
Yeah. So all on one in one area. So it's really pretty.
What's yours?
That's a tough one, too. I would say go, like, have my team win a national championship, but check that one off the list already.
He's talking about LSU.
Yeah, that's a tough one. Honestly, probably piggyback off of yours. Just keep traveling. That's my favorite thing to do. There's never a limit to any places that I want to see.
Not just the fact you said bucket list. My immediate thought was I'd like to share a meal with Jack Nicholson and Morgan Freeman.
Oh, from the movie?
Oh, wow.
And just listen to them. I was somewhere the other day, bro, and you can buy a grilled cheese sandwich, and Morgan Freeman will come down and cook that thing for you and sit down with you and eat it. It's something like 500 grand to do that.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that's what he said. It's 500 grand grilled cheese. But I just think that would be cool to sit down with those two over a meal and just listen to them talk. I bet they're a lot of fun. I know they're a lot of fun.
Yeah.
That'd probably be mine.
With minus the $500,000 that you talked about.
Yeah, just a grilled cheese. All right, brother, man. Thanks for coming back and doing this again. Chris Cassidy, we've had you on the show before, but you've done a lot since then. So I just want to back it up just a little bit just to tell the people who are new to the platform a little bit about your background, brother. So we're actually teammates. You're a Navy SEAL. But before that, where'd you grow up?
A small town in Maine, York, Maine.
Dude, we just went up there the other day to Bar Harbor.
Maine. Yeah, Bar Harbor.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful up there, man. Yeah, fantastic. So I grew up there and then got in the Navy and kind of bounced around all over just like you guys. But That's where I graduated high school.
It's a land of Subarus and Merrill shoes.
Right, you're so right.
You know what I'm talking about? Like, you know, like if they took me and you and snatched us out of somewhere and dropped us anywhere in the country, I feel like immediately you know where you're at when someone walks up on us.
Yeah.
And that's what I saw a lot of that up there. It was great.
LL Bean headquarters is up there.
LL Bean, yeah, there you go.
You could put LL Bean boots in the mix. Right.
That's right. If you want to know what the uniform of the day is up there, think LL Bean.
Yeah.
So if you don't mind just giving us a backstory on you, and we'll just kind of flow from there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, like I said, grew up in Maine. Nobody in my family was military. My dad did a little short time in Marine Reserves and kind of Vietnam time frame. He didn't, his timing didn't get him deployed over there. And so it's just real quick. So not a whole lot of military influence, but looking for a way to pay for school is what led me to the Navy. And then now everybody knows about, go ahead, Marcus, what do you got?
No, this is what people love to hear. And I love to hear this too, because we don't ever talk about this when we're in, but coming from a small town, I was like, hey man, what moment was it that grabbed your ass about being a team guy? I mean, where you were like, hey, I think I'm gonna check and do that. And were you always smart?
Well, I did fine in school. I cared more about sports, to be honest with you, than I did school.
Great answer.
I was playing a sport every season. In Texas, you got to kind of pick one sport, right? In high school, and you stick with it. And in a small town in Maine, people play football or soccer, and then on Friday the season ends. On Monday, basketball starts, and then when that season ended, baseball started, and I just kind of went with my friends through all the seasons together. But to your question about being a SEAL, I had no idea that SEALs existed. This was I graduated high school in 88. And unless you somehow had a connection to SEAL teams or the Navy, or you saw a movie or something, and none of those were true for me, I didn't even know it was a thing. I just knew I could be in the Navy and they would help me pay for college. And then once I got to college is when I learned about SEALs. And there was a mentor on the staff at the Naval Academy, and he was awesome and guided me and my classmates who were interested in the process, and it kind of educated you on what BUDS is and all that kind of stuff. So I was like, Marcus, I was probably 20 years old before it dawned on me that it was something I could do.
That's awesome. Chris, fun fact, the Naval Academy just awarded Marcus with an honorary graduate.
Oh, fantastic.
This graduation in May?
This last one.
This last May.
I already made rank. Can you believe that? Can you believe? Normally, right? The fact that I was an E6 SEAL and they dropped that freaking on me was substantial.
You know, you got to eat cake, be a cake eater.
Bro, I'm the official first mate of the Naval Academy.
Blue tile.
Yep, official first mate right here. Boom.
Yeah.
You know who was with me? Slab. So the Master Chief of the Academy is a Navy SEAL and a Medal of Honor guy. We graduated together.
Yeah, they both got it at the same time.
I knew Slab was had that last year. I didn't know you were with him, so congratulations.
He doesn't ever talk about me. Cool. No one ever does. That's because I'm still low ranking. But, hey, I still got it, though. That's a big deal for an enlisted dude. When they put that title on me, it was the best qual I got. Absolute best. Thank you so much, Naval Academy. You won't regret it. You might, but you won't.
Marcus was so excited about that.
I only knew that Slab made it. Did was there because he and I worked closely together at the Medal of Honor Museum.
How great is he, man? That guy's been watching out for me for a while too. Yeah, he's something. What are we even talking about?
Talking about him getting. Right, so your mentor led you to the SEAL teams. Did you go straight in from the Naval Academy?
Yep, I graduated Naval Academy and took a month of vacation and then went directly to Cap Coronado and was in BUDS class 192. Fortunate, didn't get hurt. You know, it's just like pro athletes, right? You're one ACL away from going to another class.
So you made it straight through?
I made it straight through, yeah.
Yeah, it must have been easy for you. Most guys who make it straight through, it's an easy path. Anyways, so how many did you start with?
I don't think BUDS can be easy for any. People say it is. Some people might say it is, but the instructors, they'll make it hard for anybody, and that's their job.
Oh, Well, yeah, okay, so are we getting real? If we're getting real, like a straight-up reality check, every guy who goes to Buzz to be an instructor, the first thing and the only thing they worry about is being the soft instructor class on the students. No one ever wanted to be, so it's hard. There's nothing easy about going through the program, absolutely. I mean, when we get older, we get soft and we talk about stuff like that, you know? But it's hard, no matter what. It's designed that way for sure.
Yeah. And that's what they should do, right? To pop out the other side as a graduate, we as a community need to know that that person's been through the ringer they're going to have your back no matter what. And that's the job of the instructors, and they do an awesome job at it.
I tell you what, I ran into a new one the other day. I mean, he's not new anymore. He's been on a couple. He's still new to us, right?
He's young.
He came walking up on me, bro. These guys look so good, so sharp. I mean, he looked like a freaking Navy SEAL. He had the 70s porn stash, freaking tight jeans over some cowboy boots. He grew up with my son, my oldest one. He freaking left and joined the team. Called back one day, called Hunter.
Yeah.
I was like, hey, I made it. I mean, bro, he's already tatted up too, dude. Yeah, he left here just a good kid, man, and now he's a SEAL, which, you know, I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but
it's cool,
man, because these kids, these new ones, they're high speed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, what we're getting now is completely different than the rough and tumbles that we came up with. We were.
Because I think, you know, that we just get natural recruitment from how much people know about SEALs now in the country, and it gives us a great problem of having just the cream of the crop getting there.
So when you graduated, what was your life like in the teams? How long did you stay in, and what was going on around the world?
What coast they send you?
Yeah, so I graduated in the spring of 94, and that was back in the day. Marcus, you and I are the same era where you went, you went to SDT, and then you got to your first team without a Trident, and you were at the team for like 6 months or
six
so.
Six months.
And so that first year post graduation was with jump school and SDT and all that stuff, and then I showed up at SDV team 2, and was a Drydeck shelter platoon commander for my first tour, which is not the job you want as a young SEAL officer, but you know what? Everything works out for the best. I was in charge of a group of divers, and then was kind of like the assistant SDV platoon commander as a side job. But I really liked working closely with the submarine and being the main liaison with the submarine for the SEAL team, and then also got to do SEAL stuff. And then I just extended for another 2 years and became the SDV platoon commander with the same submarine. So I drove up SDVs for 4 years and absolutely loved it. In fact, it's pretty near and dear to my heart. On one of my spacewalks, I took a picture of words on my spacesuit that says, "Are you just a SEAL or are you an SDVer?"
Bro,
that's
I was going to ask you about that. And that's probably one of the coolest things I've heard. Because it's all about being the top cool guy in the teams. Because when I first got in, too, I got sent to special deliveries. And I was like, man, you know, I don't know if I want to get stuck down in there. And what it led you to, obviously, it helped out. All that training, all that time underwater with the submarines, which is the hardest. Bro, you try and talk about what that's like doing that job. And when he was asking what's some of the coolest things you've ever done in the SEAL teams, I remember hanging back from the tether line. It was in the middle of the sun was up. And we got to hang off the back of the submarine on the tether line while it was underway, just kind of floating like bait. And I remember thinking, you know, you can see into the deep blue, and it's just this huge. That's the only chance in your life you'd get to see something like that. You can't paint it. There's a couple of things that we get to do and we get to see because of the job that no one else gets.
To me, that sounds like your bait.
Yeah,
for
it was.
Whale.
That's exactly what we look like.
My experience similar to that, Marcus, was you remember those things called it Fulton recovery, but basically when you simulate when the SDV is broken and you tie a rope to one end of it and one swimmer has to go with the bitter end of the rope and then the submarine intersects the line and then you have to swim around and clip the line back onto itself. I did that a number of times, and I remember this one time, it was nighttime, it was choppy, I'm going up and down, I'm floating, my buddy Travis McNeese is 75 feet away inside the SDV, And then all of a sudden the Black Submarine comes up out of nowhere. It's just unbelievable. It's I just have that memory in my head.
I'll never forget that. It's the most intimidating thing I've ever experienced in my entire life. At night with the sea stayed up, and that's 500 plus foot, 15 story tall submarine comes out, and you have a rope the size of your wrist that you got to swim around the mast on like the top of that submarine and hook in. You can't see anything.
You can't see anything. They don't stop. Kick your butt off. And I remember kicking. I could see the rope and grab it and like, and got the carabiner in there just in time. Because, man, it's a put-out evolution.
And you're asking like, hey, man, what if I don't do this right? And like, you will. Like, there's no other option. Like, they don't ever say, what if you make this mistake, you do that? No, no. That submarine's not stopping. I mean, it's moving, right? And we got to get back in there. You don't even think about it. They don't even teach us how to do that, because if they said it out loud before we got in there, they'd be like, no, I'm not doing that.
Yeah.
Chris, when you were head of the STV-2, did you ever see any mistakes done when there was a tether line like that?
So I was a platoon commander, a pretty low-level guy, not with respect to the whole team, but what I've learned in life, at time at NASA and time in the SEAL team, mistakes happen all the time. It's how you deal with them that defines the unit, the person, the entity, and fessing up to them so that the people behind you don't find those same mistakes. And sure, in training, you might not swim fast enough to hook that line in, or you might peel the wrong way on a land warfare maneuver. But that's what debriefs are for, and you get over it.
You ought to see that some of the best views you'll ever catch is a team guy trying to correct a mistake in the middle of the op. Like that, it's how fast we can do that. So guys will see it. Most of the time you see your buddy, it's happening, and we'll come up behind and fix and just do that. Or they'll catch it and they'll fix it in the middle of this thing going forward, which is pretty – it's amazing how fast we get there. And that's why we practice so much over and over again. Because the more you practice, the more mistakes show up. They just do. That's part of it. That's actually what you're looking for. And then you get good at that. And then you'll keep going. You're like, oh, and then another one will show up. And we just keep going and going. And the best part is exactly what he said is that debrief. Because we will absolutely turn around and write it down. We'll make fun of the guys who did it so we'll remember it, because it's a great story. That's how we remember. Yeah, dude, man, I forget. That's some of the best stuff. How long did you do that before you transferred out of 2?
I was at STV-2 for 4 years, 94 to 98, and then I went to graduate school, and then 2000 to 2002, I was at SEAL Team 3, Afghanistan in there, and then came back to the East Coast and was at SEAL Team 10 and Special Boat Team 20 before I went to NASA.
That's the officer route, all right. Okay, I'm curious. Everybody, when we're kids, we say we either want to be astronauts, firefighters, police officers, something like that. Astronauts, top of the list. When did that happen? Because being a Navy SEAL is one thing. You get that trident put on your chest, that's completely different than anything else. I've even talked to a couple of our congressmen and a couple of our other guys. I'm like, hey, what's cooler, being a team guy or being this? They're like, team guy, always the coolest thing ever. But when guys transfer over to the astronaut program, that's huge. When did you get and what gave you the itch for that?
Another SEAL, actually. So Bill Shepard was the first Navy SEAL to become an astronaut. And, of course, as a young guy, I knew that NASA existed. I knew that NASA had astronauts and they went to space, but that was what other people did. That's not something that lowly me could do. And then, so even when I got into SEAL teams, never even thought about it. And then finally I met Shep. I was probably a lieutenant. I just finished STV Team 2, those 4 years. And I met Bill Shepard, and he's the one that sort of enlightened me that NASA hires astronauts every so often, every 4 years or so. There's pretty basic requirements. Anybody can apply. And with his knowledge, his guidance, his mentorship, I applied. And I applied one time in 2000 and did not get selected. And then again, in 4 years later, 2004, I was just a more well-rounded applicant. I had completed graduate school. I had experience in Afghanistan, and they selected me.
Are you looking to grow your savings? Join Navy Federal Credit Union for more earning and savings opportunities. Their certificate options offer higher rates than regular savings accounts, simply just making your money work harder for you. Navy Federal stands out with various savings choices. Start with a low deposit, add funds anytime, and sit back and watch your savings grow. It's flexible, catering to both short-term and long-term goals. And if you need cash for a home improvement project or you're just consolidating debt, Navy Federal has easy options for any of it. Get a fixed-rate home equity loan with zero closing costs, allowing you to borrow up to 100% of your home's equity. Or you can just go get a home equity line of credit for flexibility. Explore Navy Federal's offerings at NavyFederal.org. Simple and rewarding. Because at Navy Federal, our members are the mission.
Is that what they're looking for most? I mean, the resume is a resume, but if it come in with experience and the aptitude for it, and that's considerable too, right?
Yeah, I mean, a good crew member on a spacecraft is just like a good crew member in a SEAL unit. You need somebody that has some smarts to them, that can think on their feet, but also knows how to balance risk. Even though we as Navy SEALs, we're all about like take it to the enemy, but you need to be smart enough to know when it's not your advantage to do that and when to lay up. Or if you're a mountain climber, the big gray cloud is coming in. Maybe today is not our day to get to the peak, so you don't go. And we at NASA are looking for people that know how to balance risk versus the mission, in addition to being trainable.
So when you got that acceptance letter, what is it's kind of like when you, is it like getting an acceptance letter to Buds? That feeling?
Well, yeah, it was really interesting because I had, when you get called for an interview at NASA, you go there and you're there for a week and a whole bunch of it is medical. There's an actual sit down interview. There's some hands on aptitude, robotics things. And then you disappear and they do about 6 or 7 weeks of 20 people. And I did my interview week and the very next week I left for 6 months to Afghanistan. So the whole time my application was pending, I was doing stuff as a SEAL in Afghanistan, and the selection office knew that I was hard to reach. So at the end of that, I was about to redeploy home. They sent me an email and said, hey, please call the selection NASA office at Monday at noon or something. And in that weekend, I had redeployed home. So I was actually in my living room in Norfolk, Virginia, on the appointed day when I was supposed to call NASA, and I knew this was the phone call. And the gouge was, if it's the head of human resources whose voice you hear, you're not going to be an astronaut. But if it's the chief astronaut, like the commanding officer.
Is that what they say? That's how they do it?
Then it might be a good call. So on the other end of the phone was the chief astronaut. And I was like, oh my God, this could be good. And he said, hey, Chris, would you like to come work with us at NASA? And man, it was such a cool moment. And off I went. The interesting thing is, we as a family knew that we were rotating, because you know how it is when you come back from deployment, you PCS and rotate and change duty stations and whatnot. So we knew we were moving that summer. It was summer 2004. And then so they just changed our orders. Instead of going to Bahrain, I went to Houston.
Oh my gosh, that's awesome. What'd your wife say?
We were all super excited, and the kids were really young, so they didn't quite get what it meant, but they knew that their parents were excited, so they were excited too.
All right, so you transfer from Virginia over to Houston, and you walk in. It's kind of like walking into the Men in Black area. I mean, with all the medical testing and how that works from all the movies that we've seen.
Yeah. You know what's pretty funny about that first week? No matter what job you do on the first couple days, you learn where you park, you get your computer, you get your badge, you find out your office and make sure you have everything. It's just basic stuff. Learn where the bathroom is. And I remember Wednesday of that first week, I came home after work and my son, who was like four, he came running up to me at the door and said, Dad, did you go to the moon today?
Oh my gosh.
I was like, no, son, check with me on Thursday. You know, we'll knock that.
How cute. How old were your kids at the time?
So he was four or five, And then 7 and 9.
All right, so is it like a selection phase when we're going through SEAL training? Each phase sucks, or is it kind of like it's a build of, like, if you made it this far, then we're just adding on to your protocols?
So it's a little different because in BUDS, the instructors don't necessarily want you, or at least you don't feel like they want you to be successful. Their make you prove it, right? When you ask, Aspinall's a little bit different. The hardest thing is getting selected. Once you're there, once you're in the club, the resources and the environment is one where they want you to be successful. It's still hard. There's still a lot of studying to do, but nobody really wants you to fail. They put a lot of resources into it at that point. So it is hard. There's a lot of studying. It's like being in graduate school where you're cramming for tests all the time. But if you don't get it, there's a instructor there that's waiting to make sure you understand what they're teaching.
How many astronauts at a time are there?
When I showed up in 2004, there was about 120 astronauts. 36 of us were active duty Navy at the time. When I left in 2021, we were down to about 40 astronauts and only 6 of us were active duty Navy. And that size difference is because we retired the shuttle. We fly, we have less of a need each year for space flight. So it's a smaller office. And then each class selection is about 10 to 12 people every 4 years.
How do you fight for the chance to get on a shuttle and do a space mission?
Well, it's not really fighting. You just kind of do your job and do it. It's good advice for any community, any business, right? Do your job, do it well.
I feel like this is a great question. Yeah.
Do your job, do it well, grind, just come to work with a good attitude and grind. And then you'll be asked to do things and doors will open. And the first 2 years as an astronaut, you're an astronaut candidate, so you're not eligible to be assigned to a mission, kind of like being in your training cell before you get to your first platoon.
God, what is that even like, man? Do they haze you, like put astronaut food in your shorts or some shit like that, dude?
No, it's very tough, more kinder, gentler
serious.
Place. Yeah,
dude. That's why it's a lot of nerds, right? That's why they put a team guy in there. You got to liven that place up, bro. I know y'all changed things.
Yeah, I did find that sense of humor, something that would be hysterically funny in a platoon hut,
is not
quite have the same
of course
humor
not.
At a group of NASA employees.
Man, you just got to bring them around to our level.
Yeah,
my great uncle was with NASA from like day one. He died a couple years ago, but he helped build design the fuselage for the shuttles. And he was with NASA all the way to retirement, retired, and then they hired him back as a consultant. I mean, he was in his 70s still consulting.
Wow.
Yeah, and then he started to get sick, so he had to stop. But I always grew up knowing him as NASA, just the engineer, that kind of person, and was always fascinated with it. And I grew up down in the Pearland area. So,
oh, did you really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I went to Webster Junior High. I mean, I was right there by NASA. So our field trips were to NASA as a kid. And I just always looked at that as like the highest anybody could ever get, like job-wise. So you wanted to be an astronaut, but nobody really made it. It was just almost like a Tom Cruise. You know, you want to be there, but nobody really gets that kind of job.
Yeah, no one knows how to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, where do you even start?
Yeah.
That's an amazing thing to me.
And that was my case. I didn't even know until Shep kind of told me and gave me the guidance on who to call and where the forms are.
That is so freaking cool. Did you have any bucket list items when you were applying that you're like, okay, when I become an astronaut,
yeah,
I want to
do a great question.
I want to do this in space.
I want to go to space. You know, it was really that simple. Once I got selected, I just want to do my first mission. And it's kind of interesting, right? Like to put it in SEAL lingo or analogies, when you do your first platoon, you don't really know what a deployment is going to be like. Every training trip is new, and then deployment comes, it's all new. And then you come back and now you've got experience under you, and there's somebody else that's new, and you're kind of helping them through the ropes. Same thing on a space crew, that first one, your eyes are wide open the whole time and you're asking the experienced people what to expect in this situation. And then your second mission for me, I knew I could do the job. I was comfortable with it. And the unknowns were less. And my third and final mission, it shifted my mindset to my job is to pass on experience to the people behind me. And it was more living the mission for them than myself.
Yeah, because who else can teach that?
Yeah, it needs to be the people that have done it.
Once you get that hands-on experience, what's it like compared to the NASA when they were putting guys on the moon and rolled up to what we're dealing with now? Like a snorkeling mask compared to a freaking dredger that we're wearing now?
You know, it's interesting. The physics is the same. So the rocket launch, the G-forces, the risk, it's all the same. The cockpits are slightly different. Now there's more automation. There's more glass on the screen, less switches. If you look at the shuttle cockpit, it's like thousands of switches all around. You look in a SpaceX capsule, those switches are now embedded into software on a screen and you just touch buttons. So it's a different look and feel, but it's still the same risks that you got to overcome. You got to overcome gravity. A big rocket has to fire and you got to survive that launch and you got to survive the reentry. And those parts are largely the same.
So the spinning room where they put you in the machine that spins you around real fast, the G-force simulator.
Yeah.
How many did you pass out? Or did you make it?
No, we don't. So a jet pilot that has to pull G's and do combat maneuvers, they experience far higher G loads than we do. And the G-force in that instance on the jet pilot, the direction of the force is this way. So the blood pools out of your head and that's when people pass out. On a spacecraft, we reorient the seats such that the direction of the force is into your chest and the blood. So the blood doesn't come out of your head and that's what causes you to pass out. So we don't necessarily pass out. And our G forces are about 3.5, which it's a lot, but it's not as much as a combat jet pilot who's yanking and banking and turning all over the place.
Okay, what was it like the first time you climbed in there? You got somebody standing on your chest, strapping you into that seatbelt, where and then halfway through the countdown, you're like, oh, I hope something goes wrong. We don't have to go. And then that thing lights under your ass. I mean, that's got to be some of the most intense.
It's pretty intense. Our shuttle, so launching from Florida in the summertime, which was when my first mission was, there's a lot of thunderstorms that happen off the coast of Florida in the summer. And we were, that caused us to delay a number of times and it's some technical issues. So we actually woke up on five different days thinking it was launch day and it was canceled for some reason at different times. So three of those times we actually got into the vehicle and then had to get out. Two of them, we were canceled before we even went, put our suits on. But it was the sixth launch attempt where we actually went. And because of all of those delays, I tell kids, imagine your parents tell you, hey, tomorrow's Christmas morning. And you wake up and they're like, no, it's going to be Friday. And you wake up Friday. No, it's going to be next Tuesday. They wake up next Tuesday. No. And eventually you don't believe it. You don't believe you're really going. And that was the case for us. I remember thinking, there's gray clouds out there. This is a bunch of crap. We're not going to launch today. And then all of a sudden, we got the go to launch at 9. There's 9 minutes left in the count. And that's to your point, Mark. It's like, holy cow, this is it. It's game on. And I remember just being super focused on my switches and my screen and being what I had to be responsible for. And then after the ascent, when the engines cut off, thinking, holy cow, we just left planet Earth, unbelievable.
What's that feel like? I mean, what does that feel like when, I want to know, when that fire lights under your ass and that thing starts to move, are you just like, is there a pucker factor? Like you can't, because
a pucker factor. If you don't have a little pucker factor, you don't understand and appreciate the physics that are going on behind you, right? So there's a little bit of that, but it's also just kind of like a group of SEALs exiting the ramp of a helicopter at a combat zone or opening the hangar outer door to launch a submarine at night with Sea State, you're switched on. Like you're there, you're trained. This is your operational moment. This is your Super Bowl. And so you're totally dialed in from an operator perspective, and you kind of compartmentalize, probably the same as you, Marcus, you compartmentalize that part, the fear part a little bit, and do what you got to do
right in that moment.
But to answer your question, what's that feel like? On a physical sense, the thrust of the rocket is calculated to lift it off the pad at its very heaviest moment, which is fully fueled on the pad. And in the case of the shuttle, every 10 seconds, we would burn about a backyard swimming pool worth of fuel. And so you're getting that much lighter every 10 seconds and with the same thrust. And there's not to get too geeky, but in physics, there's a fundamental equation called F equals MA, force equals mass times acceleration. So if the mass goes down and the force is always the same, if the mass goes down, the acceleration has to climb. And that's when so initially, right away, right at time zero, time 1 second, 2 seconds, it wasn't as big of a push in my back as I thought because the acceleration high yet. And then every 10 seconds, you're dropping all this weight and the acceleration has to increase to match it.
So which one's the big one?
Yeah, 30 seconds, 40 seconds into it, you're really humping along and you're starting to get pushed back in your seat. Your face is like this and it's difficult to lift your arms up. But it's pretty intense.
And then when you break through the atmosphere and it goes to, and you see this, you can feel it come off, I imagine.
Yeah, at the end of the 8.5 minutes, when the engine's cut off and you go from 3 Gs to zero instantly, you just have this floating sensation. You're still buckled in with your harness, but your brain is kind of tumbling. And that's when it's easy to get sick, like being seasick, because your eyes are telling you one thing, that you're not moving, but your brain, your ears are telling you that you're tumbling. And we all take seasickness medication on the launch pad because of that.
Did you have to practice in the Vomit Comet, the C-131?
You know, you don't do the Vomit Comet as much as people might think. I did it once as an astronaut candidate, but it's not anything that is incorporated into training on a regular basis. It's more for testing experiments than testing people. We use the T-38 a little bit for some, you know, fun G training, but there's no... Yeah. I've only been in the Vomit Comet once.
Now you just keep it around and pick on people.
Well, my best friend's dad ran the Vomit Comet. Like, my whole childhood, that's what he did. And there was one test that they had to do an experiment on a cat in space. So they brought their household cat that I played with all the time. And there's a video, if you go on YouTube and look up Vomit Comet cat, you can see their cat just, like clawing at space, floating around.
Yeah.
Okay, so when you hit the out of the atmosphere and you go to start to floating around, what do you just have a little free time to figure it out? I mean, when you're docking with that space station, is that just not got to be the hairiest thing, bro? Kind of like doing a pier tie off. But if you screw that up, then it's all bets are off.
That you're exactly right. So it's a very specific trajectory that you have to be on to rendezvous. The way I describe it is, imagine a receiver is running along a post route, a deep pass, and the quarterback can throw a lobbing pass, and then the receiver can adjust a little bit his speed to time it to catch the ball. But if the quarterback throws a direct line drive, the ball has to be perfectly thrown. The receiver has to keep the same stride so that everything the ball meets the receiver right at the same time. And so a rendezvous to the space station is kind of like that line drive throw. We have to launch from Florida at exactly the right moment when the space station is in a perfect spot in the sky so that we rendezvous together. And on the shuttle, we rendezvoused in two and a half days after launch, which gave us a little bit of wiggle time to adjust if you didn't have a perfect launch and you could adjust some with some burns after the fact. In the Soyuz and now with SpaceX, we rendezvous in the same day, like 6 or so hours later, and there's much less allowable errors. So you really have to be dialed in on your maneuvers to rendezvous. Otherwise, you'll never get there.
So SpaceX is the new quarterback.
SpaceX is the new quarterback, yep.
So I got some questions people were wanting me to ask you. First time you got to go to the bathroom up there, pain in the ass or what? Literally or physically?
So number one is easy. You just pee in a tube and it doesn't require anything that anybody couldn't walk off the street and do. Number two is a little different because the hole is only like that big. And so lining that up with your business end of the rifle takes some challenge.
You want to make sure that accidentally started floating away while that was going down.
It all goes in and you don't want a messy one. I've had a few disasters up there I don't want to go into the gore details, but it takes far longer to clean yourself up and clean the toilet.
Dude, that's awesome. Of course it happened to you, team guy. All right. Yeah. And then my chief wanted to know, when you lock into the space station, does it smell like it does when we get into a submarine?
No. The submarine has, for those that have never been on one, it has a very distinct smell, and your clothes all smell like it, and you come home and you will need to leave your clothes
that's
in the garage.
That's not even accurate. That's a light description of what a submarine does to
yeah.
It
smells awful.
It is not that way on the space station. It smells like normal house.
How do they do that? Is that classified? I mean, I was so curious about that because I ran into one of my para bags the other day in the barn that I use for sub-ops, and when I opened that thing up, that smell hit me in the face. My suit and everything was still saturated.
All these years later. There. Yeah.
I mean, like wrenches, metal wrenches will smell like it.
It'd be interesting to know. That's a good project. I should do some digging in. Why do submarines smell that way, and what do they have that we don't have on? Because it's essentially the same,
it's gotta be the same
services
right?
needed. You got to make air and you got to deal with the CO2 that you exhaust and all that stuff. But
yeah, he was curious about that. He asked me and I was like, that's a great question. Because, you know, I think that smell after a few years did something to me. You know what I mean? They always say a submariner's a little off.
How long are you gone on a space mission from liftoff to coming home?
Okay, let me put you on something real quick. The Ghost Bed has got to be the most comfortable mattress I've ever laid down on. Ever since I first got my hands on one of these, I've been sleeping like a champ every single night. With over 20 years of expertise, Ghost Bed has crafted the perfect mattress using high-quality materials and a patented cooling technology. And here's the best part. With Ghost Bed's 101 night sleep trial and free shipping, trying it out is risk-free and super convenient. They offer a wide variety of mattress types from the luxurious Ghost Bed Luxe to the unique feel of the Ghost Bed Flex Hybrid. Ghost Bed really sets themselves apart with their customer satisfaction, and they even have sleep experts that will help you every step of the way if you're not sure which mattress is going to fit you the best. Plus, our listeners right now get an exclusive 50% off with code TNQ at ghostbed.com/TNQ. That's 50% off, folks. I promise you won't want to pass that up. Don't settle for restless nights. Go upgrade to Ghost Bed and start sleeping like a dream. Visit ghostbed.com/TNQ today.
The shuttle was limited to 2 weeks long, 2 week durations because of how much oxygen we could put in the tanks and some technical reasons. My second and third missions, I stayed on board for 6 months. I launched on a Russian Soyuz, which launches from Kazakhstan. So I actually left my house in Houston about 5 weeks before the launch. So I was gone from my house for 7+ months in both those.
I remember talking to you about that right before you were going to leave, how that was going to go. And then we were doing the tour of NASA. They had the capsule that you were going to return in the beginning.
Yeah,
like, hey,
tiny.
You go, the Russians made that one. I was like, is there any upgrades? He goes, if it ain't broke, they don't try and fix it.
Yeah, right, exactly.
I was like, man, you just hit the ground in that suppository looking thing with an, and you're like, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what it looked like.
Yeah.
And now, I mean,
is that what lands in the water?
That's one of them. This one landed on the ground.
It lands on the land, yeah.
Oh, wow. What's that impact like?
Pretty substantial.
It's got to be like great for you.
It's like driving a Volkswagen Bug into a brick wall at about 25 miles an hour. It's like it's a good thud.
Oh my gosh.
And it's not a big cat. I mean, you're smashed in there. I remember looking at it and I was like, man, where do you sit? He's like, right in this thing.
I was on that tour, but I didn't realize that you actually landed on land. Yeah. I thought they all landed in the water.
He's like, no, hey,
SpaceX lands on water, and early NASA missions capsules landed on the water as well. The one thing, and Marcus, you'll appreciate this as a SDVer, when you land on water, it might be softer, but the mission is not over.
Yeah, I mean,
mission is not over until you're on the ship. The nice thing about landing on land is you land, it's a good thud, but as soon as you stop, the mission's over. You can climb out and you're safe.
Do you feel okay for the next few days when you're landing, or do you have wobbly knees?
You know, we're all wobbly. We have good exercise equipment up there, so our muscles are strong and we're generally fit, but they're not. Your muscles and your balance system aren't used to working together, so you're very uncoordinated, very wobbly, very unstable. We're not allowed to drive a car for 2 weeks or ride a bicycle for 2 weeks. I'd say it takes about a month to be totally normal again. If you saw me at HEB getting groceries at week two, you couldn't tell, but I can still tell.
Mm. What do y'all call that? Getting your earth legs back?
Yeah, just kind of getting used to gravity again. I don't think we have any special.
So as soon as you flew into the space station, you locked in there and you're like, hey, what's up, Chris? What do you do next? Do they give you? I mean, there's got to be a routine every down to the second, so you don't. Yeah. Crazy, right?
So launch day is a long day. And so from the moment you wake up on launch day until you dock to the space station, you've been up for about 24 hours or some long amount of time. So you're pretty tired. We're required to have a safety briefing, and where even though we're trained and we know all that stuff, but you still have about an hour of just safety briefing. And if you've never been there before, you need to know where the bathroom is and where you're going to sleep that night. And a good crew member who's on board will have your sleeping bag already out. We'll have a toothbrush there for you, and we'll have made some drinks and a couple snacks for you. So it's pretty seamless. And you just kind of do that stuff, say hi real quick and go to bed. And then you get into the working aspect of the next day once you've slept.
What's that like?
If you've been there before, it's largely kind of like coming home again. And so you don't need a whole lot of introduction to the bathroom and things. You just dive right into it.
What's it like sleeping the first time?
It's a little weird because think about when you go to bed out here on Earth, you know you're kind of tired. It's the end of the day. You brush your teeth. You put on your sleeping clothes. You maybe read a book or watch Netflix or whatever. And then you lie in bed and you have comfort feeling on your whole body that's touching the mattress, and your pillow is touching your head, and you're just all comfy. And that all those sequences tell you that it's time to go to sleep. The weird thing about going to space is we do brush our teeth, we do put on sleeping clothes, but there's no sensation on your body of a mattress. There's no sensation on your head of a pillow. So I found my first time, like, it's difficult to all of a sudden switch your brain. Okay, now I gotta sleep. Just close your eyes and try to sleep without any sort of the normal feelings. So it took me a week or 10 days to get used to the act of going to sleep. But once you fall asleep, you sleep really soundly and well and no problem.
What about water? Do we have to transport that up there? We figured out a way to harness something else.
We can make it. The bulk of the water gets launched up there as water in bags. But we also have oxygen and hydrogen gas up there, and there's machines that can combine the two and make water. Water is a precious resource, like food and fuel. It's a commodity that we track very closely. We always try to have like 6 months worth of extra consumables, extra food and water, such that if a cargo ship's all of a sudden for whatever reason couldn't get there, we have a few months of living in reserve.
And there's jettison pods, like lifeboats up there attached for you guys at all times, right?
The vehicle that brings you up is it stays connected, and it's your emergency escape if you need it. It's also the normal way to get home at the end of your time.
What would cause you to have an emergency escape?
Well, there's lots of different reasons. A fire, just like a fire on a ship, you got to fight the fire. We do the same thing on the space station. If you had a fire, you got to put it out. Or if you can't put it out, you close hatches and isolate compartments. If it overcomes the whole thing, you got to leave. A impact by a piece of space debris would be another reason. If it's small enough, you know, you could just isolate the hatches and close that little section off, and you lost that section. But if it's catastrophic enough and in the right spot that impacts the whole entire space station, you'd have to get out of Dodge in that instance as well.
Has that happened?
It hasn't yet.
That thing just keeps growing, right? That's what happened. It started off as, like, say, a little cabin in the woods, and then eventually it turned into a mobile home, and then eventually it's going to turn into a house. That's what we're doing, right? We just keep adding on to it.
Yeah, it's largely, you're correct. It's largely built out now. There are some commercial companies that have business plans to start building on the government part of the space station, build out commercial modules, and that will happen eventually. But right now, the government construction of the space station, it's at its maximum size.
So we're going back to the moon?
Yeah, we are. We don't have a lander or suits that you can walk in right now, but those are all being contracts are given to provide those things. So my friends and former colleagues will launch in an Orion capsule next year and go around the moon, orbit the moon. And then a couple of years later after that, once we have the infrastructure to go to the surface, we'll send people back to the surface of the moon.
And yeah, just that'll be a jumping off spot, right? We'll just set up a base there, and then from there we can go deeper and further.
Yep. There's different concepts, but one of those is to have a lunar outpost in orbit of the moon where you can get to the surface of the moon if you want, or you can launch, like you said, deeper.
There's so many naysayers now that are saying that the walking on the moon never happened. What do you say to that conspiracy?
Yeah, just don't give it a whole lot of attention, because we did.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Having my great uncle in NASA at that time, and I mean, that's like his life story is talking about that mission, and hearing people now saying it didn't happen, it hurts a little. It's like, how can you think that didn't happen? That was such an important mark in history.
Yeah.
It's like saying the Alamo didn't happen, that we just made
exactly,
it up.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You just kind of dismiss it.
Talking the other day that a lot of stuff that we're looking to invent, or that we have the ideas in our head, we still have to find the minerals that will help us accomplish that are actually out in space.
Mm-hmm.
I never thought about it like that, but a lot of stuff that we're looking forward to, we got to go find it.
You know, energy is a big deal here on Earth, right? And power generation I've seen cool concepts of generating power on the moon, for example, and ways that to beam that power back down to Earth, all kinds of cool things. Space can be very, very useful for us.
So just one more question. When you're in space and you're out floating around, and it's space. It's not like floating around when you're in the ocean. If you had a pair of fins on, you couldn't just kick it and move, right? You can't create your own force.
Exactly. There's no air molecules around you. So if you kicked, you're not pushing against anything. There's no force to react against. So you could be, if my arm is the handrail, you could be this far away from the handrail and you can never get there. So we're always tethered, just like a rock climber or smart rock climbers. You're always tethered in some way with either a short little, what do we call those things in the SEAL team? Like a little dog lead or something, you know, where you clip in and then rest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Take a bite. So let me ask you a question. So the only reason that the shuttles can move is because it pushes off the Earth and then it pushes off the space station.
Well, the impulse that an engine gives does provide that acceleration to go in a direction. That's how you move. Little control rockets, when you're up there, there's, and the shuttle is called RCS, Reaction Control System, little engines that would fire in all different directions to make you maneuver and go. And then we had bigger engines in the back that could do orbital maneuvering and change your altitude.
So what is it pushing off of?
That impulse it's like sitting in a chair with wheels on it and pushing against the wall. Every action has a reaction. And in this case, it's going the opposite direction of the put of the engine. I'm not really explaining that well, but
you know what I'm trying to ask?
Line of questioning is
going.
Great.
Yeah. So what are the thrusters? Are they reverse thrusters and actually pushing the shuttle itself? I'm just curious.
The shuttle just goes the opposite direction of where the engine is pushing.
Yeah, but what's it pushing off of? If there's nothing there, that's what my question was.
That's
pretty deep.
That's one of the engineers.
God dang it! Give me an engineer in here.
It's giving an impulse that the shuttle will then that energy has to go somewhere, and it goes. The energy of the engine firing goes into the vehicle, and it starts moving.
I see that. That's a deep question. Okay, man.
I know you're limited on time, and that is extremely fascinating. But now, so you went from space to working at the Medal of Honor Museum. How did you transition to that?
Yeah, well, it's a good job, by the way, for picking that up.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah, it's a real honor to be here, and I love being around military people, and especially the heroes like the Medal of Honor guys. So, you know, life is interesting with networks of people, and my swim buddy and buds, a guy named Mike Hayes, he retired from the Navy after a command tour at SEAL Team 2, and he was in business, and he had then become affiliated with the Medal of Honor Museum and was on the board of directors. And when I was retiring from the Navy and NASA in 2021, he called me and said, "Hey, what are you going to do when you retire?" And I was like, "I don't know. I don't have really plans yet." And he, "Well, why don't you come learn about the Medal of Honor Museum? We might need some help with leadership." And so I did. I just drove from Houston one day, came up to Dallas, Arlington, and learned about the project, saw where the site would be, met the community and met the mayor, and really got excited about what the project was. Certainly I knew of the Medal of Honor and what that meant as a military guy, but you know, there's a lot of other things involved with it too. And it just felt right. And they offered me the job. And I was glad to accept. And since then we started construction. The museum is a year from opening. If you drive by up here now, you'll see the structure is up out of the ground, and we're enclosing it with drywall and all that right now, actually. And really, really super cool. A lot of support from, we're right in the middle of the Cowboys organization and the Texas Rangers. Both those stadiums are next door. Both those teams, and it's just really, really cool.
Are you like around ballpark? Is that the street?
Yeah, in fact, the office I'm in is the old Texas Rangers ballpark. It's now called Choctaw Stadium, but they turned the outfield boxes and suites into office space. So I'm out that window right there. Is the used to be called the XFL. Now it's the UFL. They're practicing. The Arlington Renegades are practicing because their season starts.
Oh, but, funny.
So you got a corner office and you get to watch football?
I get to watch football, right?
Are you still cool in, technically?
No, he retired 2021.
Okay.
But did you what?
I was asking, are you technically still in? Because that's one of the greatest military lifestyles I've ever heard in my entire life. People always like, hey, is the military a good place to be? I'm like, yes, it is. If you know where to go, I mean, some of the guys we talk to have the best lives.
Yeah, no, I'm a straight up civilian now.
Wow, dude, man, that's awesome.
Good job. That's a really cool area. When Hunter was a baby, we lived off of Ballpark right by the post office.
Oh my gosh, it's right here.
Yeah, we lived right there.
So what can we do, man, and what can our listeners do to help with the Medal of Honor Society?
Well, real quick, what is it doing? Like, what's the museum going to showcase?
Yeah, that's a great question, Melanie. So there's other museums where you can go and learn about World War II, for example, in New Orleans. You can go see airplanes in Pensacola or Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. This is not going to be a military history museum. This is going to be a museum totally focused on the stories of people, biographies of individual people who are normal Americans that did something extraordinary when the nation asked them to do it, kind of like you, Marcus. And we are going to focus on this, those people as individuals, and hopefully that will light a fire with visitors and young people, particularly where they can be inspired to demonstrate courage in their own life. We're also standing up a leadership institute, which has a large K through 12 component to it on character values and character excellence. And we're in classrooms right now with a partnership with an NFL program, and then a monument on the Mall in DC. But if you guys want to come to baseball season is about to start. If you guys want to come to a Rangers game, maybe when the Astros are in town, or I assume you guys are Astros fans.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we'll look at
it's the only time you divide Texans. Mm-hmm. Is when you we got neutral gang colors down here. We're Astros and Texans, man. But you know, if we ease up north, it's just a thing. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I know. I moved from Houston too, so I had to adapt and overcome and be in the environment that I'm in. But in all seriousness, if you want to come up, we can make that happen. And I'd love to host you guys for a Rangers game against the Astros.
Done. Sold. I'm sorry.
For the museum itself, is it like largely digital and holographic, like a lot of the new museums, or is it more wax museum type? What's it going to look like?
Yeah, no, that's a wonderful question. So anymore, you can't build a museum where it's just read a plaque, go to the next plaque, read a plaque, go to the next plaque. People check out. I check out after two, three plaques. So you got to have a dynamic engagement way. And it needs to be, if you come this year, we can change things out. So we encourage people to want to come back 6 months, a year later, so that there's fresh content. There's been 3,519 Medals of Honor awarded ever since the Civil War. 63 of those people are still alive. Today,
that's all we got left.
There's no way we could tell 3,500 stories in a museum. You just can't do it. So we had to select down to, we can tell about 90 stories in different ways in the museum. So, and then maybe half of those we can change out the content. Sure. There's some of them where we have artifacts for that. It's just a little harder to change it out because you build the case and the structure around those artifacts. But anyway, that's what it'll be.
That's cool. It's almost like at the museums in Houston, how they have exhibits coming through and it changes it up. Yours will have just different Medal of Honor recipients at different times.
And then digital content in the mix of all that, and some other cool stuff that we really are done a lot of research to deliver a product to the country that's cutting edge in terms of a museum experience.
Matthew, I remember when we were in, AFI's, the news network we had? It was called that, right? AFN. They would have those Medal of Honor moments.
Oh, right.
Remember that? And I mean, they would actually make a short little video of the whole, there's this one guy, an officer, wrapped the explosives around him, climbed up the hill to blow up the wire so they could take them. I'll never forget that guy. And I learned that watching that. So when, you're right, that visual, like kids these days, the plaques, they can't.
Yeah.
I don't know what happens, but when you have that virtual and that visual thing, they remember it quickly.
Yeah.
I know it's hard to pick favorites, but do you have a couple of Medal of Honor stories that have just, they drive you?
It's so hard, right? They're all amazing. And when you think you've read every amazing thing, you flip a page to another person and you're like, holy cow. Slab's action. I was one ridgeline away in Afghanistan listening to that whole thing on the radio. So that one is personal for me. There's a helicopter pilot that's on our board member, one of our board members, General Pat Brady. His story of flying three helicopters back into the same combat zone. He needed three because the first two kept on getting shot up, but he just kept on going back to save people, right? Like, he knew there were more people that need to be saved. I don't know, Melanie, it's so hard. It's so hard to nail down one.
Was Roy Benavidez a Medal of Honor?
Yeah. Man.
Roy Benavidez, yeah. A Texan.
Yeah, Texan.
And that's exactly how I say it. People, hey, what's your favorite Medal of Honor story? I'm like, that's not how that works.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm like, every time you flip through that book, And I don't know how y'all award that. That's got to be tough because there's guys who are like, hey, man, this medal is – this story is so crazy, man. You can't give it that medal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or it's too crazy. No one believes it.
Yeah.
Dakota's was like that.
Yeah, Dakota.
Slavs was like that.
Yeah.
We got Bri.
And Mike Thornton.
Mike Thornton's is crazy.
Mike Thornton, Tommy Norris.
Tommy Norris.
Those got to be amazing.
That one right there in itself because they all they flipped on each other. That was a good one.
There's so many great ones. So
Mike Murphy. I mean, you could just get Mansoor when he jumped on that friggin' grenade. And then it goes all the way back.
And we're just talking about SEALs because they're the ones that we know fresh in our heads. But it just keeps on going. You read these World War One guys that are in trenches and crawling. It's just amazing. It blows my mind.
So when's the open date?
1 year from right now, March 23rd, 24th of next year, 2025.
And how can people follow along the building of it? Is there social media built up for it?
There's social media. MOHmuseum.org is our website. There's some links there. You can learn more, donate if you want to. Every dollar helps. But really, it's about awareness for us. Letting people know that we're coming. And we're on LinkedIn and Instagram and all that stuff.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing this.
Yeah, great job, man.
Yeah. We're excited for this, and we'll definitely make it up to a baseball game. And
so, have you and the other team guys done anything crazy or cool? Like, have you marked up the space station or pounded a trident in the side of it? I mean, you got to represent, all right? You got to do that. I know Mario's. I know now you got some younger team guys underneath you that are astronauts now. So I've been keeping track of them.
Yeah, in my total time at NASA, I flew about 10 tridents in space, and I've given most of those out, but I still have 3, I think, at home. So
sweet, pencil man for one.
There's a couple SEAL stickers at various places on the space station.
I can't wait till I get the one you got for me. You just can't throw that out there in front of a team guy. You hear what he said? He's like, I got some extra ones. No, you don't. You got one, and then the other two go to me and my brother playing stuff.
Oh, my gosh.
All right, brother, man. Thanks again for doing this.
Thank you so much for coming
on. Fantastic, guys. Great to see you as always.
God bless you. We'll see you soon.